God is my strong fortress, and he makes my way perfect. He makes me as sure-footed as a deer, enabling me to stand on mountain heights. He trains my hands for battle. He strengthens my arm to draw a bronze bow. You have given me your shield of victory. Your help has made me great. You have made a wide path for my feet to keep them from slipping. May God add a blessing to his reading of his word.
Everyone been doing good? Having a good week? All right. Well, if you are a little tired, feel free to take a nap, because that's normally what I do when Kelly's up here, so it's fine. The truth will set you free. All right. No, but seriously, I really hope everyone's been having a really great week. It's been a little interesting for me. The co-hosts know all about it, but that is a sermon for another Sunday. I had a hard time kind of figuring out what I wanted to share today, but I promised I spent like a good couple minutes on it, figured that out. Just kind of upstage me, man. I spent a good couple minutes on what I was going to speak about. That's why it has such a vague title. But I want to speak to you guys on greatness. I chose that verse today because I loved how verse 36 went. In my version, I have NIV. You make your saving help my shield. Your help has made me great. And I've been thinking a lot about the idea that we can't be great on our own, and our greatness and anything that we can do all comes from God. And so, you know, thinking about, you know, what do I share with a congregation that I've been here, never spoken at before? I've only, you know, sat down on, I can count on two hands how many sermons I've been. But I really think that I can give an example of how we can be great on his terms. In a play, The Twelfth Night, William Shakespeare. How many of you guys like Shakespeare? You guys are weird. It is Portland. But Shakespeare writes in his play, The Twelfth Night, "Be not afraid of greatness. Some are born great, some achieve greatness, and others have greatness thrust upon them." So that's in your bulletin. You can take notes alongside with me. And as long as I can remember, that quote has been stuck in my head, and I could never get the words right until I finally looked it up. Some are born great, others achieve greatness, and others have greatness thrust upon them. And if we look around in our day-to-day lives, I think we can see different examples of people who have been born great, achieved greatness, and also had greatness thrust upon them. For example, there could be someone who is the son or daughter of like a wealthy CEO, or even just someone who started their own business, and they come up and grow up and take over that company and lead it into another great generation. I think that would be someone who was born great because they were born into that position. There's a student maybe who's worked hard in school or on the athletics team and become the next star pupil or star athlete. That would be someone who has achieved greatness. And then there might be an individual who has been raised in a less fortunate situation and working alongside a parent or guardian to provide for their family. That would be somebody who has had greatness thrust upon them. And so now you can think to yourself, what kind of role are you in? Are you somebody who has been born into greatness, someone who has achieved greatness, or someone who's just had greatness thrust upon you? If we look at the entire Bible, it's a big book, there are a lot of people that we could analyze, and sadly, we just don't have that time today. But if you ever want to just ask Kelly, I'm sure he'd be willing to sit down for a couple weeks. If you all want to turn with me into Genesis 37, verses 1 through 11, we're going to meet one gentleman who achieved greatness. Charles R. Swindoll once said, "We are all faced with a series of great opportunities brilliantly disguised as impossible situations. And Joseph is one man who encountered many impossible situations that turned out to be great opportunities." Born as one of the last of Jacob's children, he was very much his father's favorite. His brothers despised him for that, and so after trapping him in a pit one day, they sold him into slavery into Egypt and faked his death. He was sold to the household of Potiphar, and Joseph became a servant and served under him for many years. And we're going to read in verse 37. We're going to see the final straw that sent his brothers over the edge. I just realized I'm also in NIV, so there's a little bit of a word exactly. Jacob lived in the land where his father had stayed, the land of Canaan. This is the account of Jacob's family line. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and he brought their father a bad report about them. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons, because he had been born to him in his old age, and he made an ornate robe for him. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright, while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it." His brothers said to him, "Do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us?" And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. Then he had another dream, and he told it to his brothers. "Listen," he said, "I had another dream, and this time the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." When he told his father as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you?" His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. So Joseph literally has just had two prophetic dreams where he himself is elevated above his older brothers, his dad, and his mom. Now, where are the parents in here? Can you just raise your hand? How would you react if your youngest kid just walked up and was like, "Hey, someday you're bowing down to me. I'm in charge of you. You do what I say." It wouldn't go over well. Where are the siblings? If your younger sibling said that to you, a little pop in the face maybe? I don't know. Is that allowed anymore? I don't know. But sure enough, those dreams actually come to fruition. He worked so hard as a slave in Potiphar's house, who was also like one of the highest commanding officers in Egypt, that he ended up having command over the entire household, all the servants and everything, and he was subordinate only to Potiphar and his wife. But even she wanted a little piece of Joseph. If you guys don't know the story, she actually came to Joseph and tried to get him to sleep with her. And he refused to disrespect not only his master, but God. And he fled from her advances, and she frames him of rape, and he was imprisoned. So he goes from being his father's favorite down to being trapped in a pit and his death being faked, sold into slavery, working as a servant for many years, but then he becomes the best of all the servants. Now, he's in prison. So this guy's life has literally just become kind of like one of those like beeping hearts. Da-dum, da-dum. It just goes up and back down and down and farther down. Went back up, farther down again. It's, he ends up in prison. God used him to interpret the dreams of other people, though, while he was in prison. And several years later, he ended up being released from prison to enter the court of the Pharaoh. He interprets two of the Pharaoh's prophetic dreams of a famine that was coming and how to survive it, which led to his being anointed and placed in the second command over all of Egypt. It's very much an underdog story. He took the situations he was in. Joseph performed to the best of his ability. He remained hardworking. He remained honest. And he remained humble, which led to his promotion from Israelite slave to Pharaoh's right-hand man. Joseph prepared and saved enough grain, not only for the Egyptians in that famine, but even for the surrounding countries, which led to the Israelites, his people, to seek food in Egypt, and it led to his reunion with his father and his brothers, and that's where the Israelites come living into Egypt. Now, seeing how Joseph came to make the most of his circumstances and achieve greatness, we'll see how Moses, our next individual, had greatness thrust upon him. We'll find in the first chapter of Exodus, you guys can turn there with me, that the Israelites had taken to living in Egypt, becoming fruitful and multiplying to where the land was filled with them. After Joseph and that whole generation had died out, a king was appointed and came into power, and he knew nothing about Joseph and anything he had done. So he sees his country filled with all of these Israelites outnumbering the Egyptian people, and he was not having any of that. So he decided he's going to make them slaves. Their numbers keep increasing, so he works them harder, and they still keep having more kids. So, obviously, the logical thing to do is kill the baby boys. He takes all of his soldiers and sends them out to households to kill all of the little children. And a woman who had had her baby boy hides him for 3 months, and when she can hide him no longer, she puts him in a basket and sends him off down the Nile River, basically to fend for himself. The Pharaoh's daughter is the one who ends up actually drawing him out of the water and names him Moses. He grows up as an Egyptian in the lap of luxury, and we see that one day he witnesses an Egyptian beating up a Hebrew. So the next day, that evening, he kills the Egyptian man thinking no one has seen him. But he was found out the next day, and he flees into the desert and ends up marrying a shepherd's daughter. During his little time out in the desert, he's tending his father-in-law's flocks and ends up running into this burning bush and having a conversation with it, you know? Kind of like chill, like, hey, you're on fire. How's it going? So in Exodus 3, 5 through 10, you can actually see this conversation. Do not come any closer, the bush says, which is God. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. Then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. At this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. The Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land into good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. So he has literally just been commanded by God, go, do this. And Moses tried arguing with him, you know, like, I have a stutter, so I'm not very good at talking, so you want me to go and tell the Pharaoh all this stuff? And God actually says, yeah, just take your brother with you. He'll do the talking. You're going to go. And so Moses has to go and confront the Pharaoh. And the man who was afraid to leave the desert comes forth down in front of Pharaoh, calls down 10 different plagues upon him with the same message, let my people go. The Pharaoh relents and then changes his mind and sends soldiers after the escaping Israelites. He leads Moses to the Red Sea and he parts it, leading the Israelites through, and then he drops the water back down on those Egyptians. If I can put that into a better context, though, there's an Old Testament and Hebrew scholar, Dr. Benj Foreman. He lives and teaches in Israel. He claimed that the greatest event in the Old Testament is the Exodus. Moses had led the Israelites through 40 years of the greatest and the most significant period of Jewish history, and he couldn't have done that if God had not told him, go. God commanded him, and so therefore, I think he was one who had greatness thrust upon him. He has no other choice than to act with accordance to what God had willed. And even when he tries to talk his way out of it, God said, go. These two also shared some common similarities other than the situations they were in. Joseph and Moses, if you just take note, you can remember in this day and age when the world around you puts you under a microscope, because the first thing is that those who do great things are obedient to God. If we look to Moses, he tried to get out of what he was commanded to do, and he was unsuccessful. He went to the Pharaoh and begrudgingly rescued the Israelite people, but he was successful, and his obedience was used to show the power and might of God against a culture that has a God for anything and everything. One of the themes I studied in school is the question, you know, why didn't God just send one plague and get it over with the first time? And they think that God, you know, hardened Pharaoh's heart, made him say yes, then say no, and have this whole back and forth 10 different times was that so God could show his might and his power over 10 very different and very, very powerful Egyptian gods that they worshipped. And so in a way, he showed that he was greater than any power they had. And so it's kind of like the ultimate insult you can ever give to a culture. One God defeated 10 without breaking a sweat. Joseph was given dreams that prophesied his ascent to authority, and he couldn't have expected it would have happened the way it did, but he worked hard and earned it every step of the way. And he probably could have gotten away with sleeping with Potiphar's wife, but he probably wouldn't have gotten away with it. He could have done it, but it would have bit him in the tushy in the end. He remained humble and respectful, not only of his God, but his master too. He gave God credit and said, "I cannot interpret dreams, but I serve a God who will tell me what it means." He put the credit where the credit was due. And it applies to us as well. When God tells you or he tells me something to do, we should do it. If you're not sure what exactly it is, if it doesn't sound right, like, "Oh, okay, God, I sure," read your Bible, because this is what's going to tell you what's right and wrong. If you hear something or are told something that's inconsistent with what you've been reading and what you believe, don't do it. I remember watching, anyone watch Cops? That old TV show? My dad loved that show to the point where when my little brother wanted his attention, he'd crawl up into his lap and sing, bad boys, what you gonna do? It was weird. I tried it, didn't work as well, you know, not as cute. But I remember seeing an episode where this guy is in a parking lot ramming cars back and forth, police cars, just hitting one, backing up into the other, and he's running them over with his truck, and they ask him, "Why did you do that?" after they had apprehended him. And he said, "God told me to. God told me to hit the police cars." He was probably on drugs. So this is your guide for interpreting what God says. And when God has you on a mission, obey his commands. Walk righteously, just like Joseph did. Don't cheat, steal, bribe, lie, or sleep your way to the top. I don't think there are many of us, if any, who would attempt any of those, but the deal is that the world is out there watching us, all of us, just waiting for us to step a toe out of line. And so I would just want to remind us all, live in accordance with what God has commanded. Another thing that they both had in common was that they were both incredibly faithful to God. Joseph was attacked by his brothers, sold, worked to the bone, seduced, thrown in prison, and left there to rot. He overcame all of those situations with his faith in God, and he lived happily ever after, essentially, kind of like the weird Disney princess. Moses was faithful to God for over 40 years while stuck in the desert. And I mean, I don't know exactly what the entire lifespan was from the moment of the burning bush to the time he passed away, but that is a lot of faith. And their faith was so great that they're included in what I call the Hall of Faith in Hebrews 11. So no matter where you're going, be faithful to God and keep his commands. But the last example I have of somebody who was born great has a little bit of a unique story, because Jesus was somebody who was born to a virgin named Mary, which is impossible for those of you that don't know, and he claimed to be the Son of God. So those are pretty great circumstances, I would say. I mean, any of you could disagree with me. You'd be wrong, but you can disagree. He had four Gospels written about him, so going into his backstory is going to be a little bit more difficult, but you can, again, talk to Kelly. He'll sit through that with you. And we'll read in John 12, 37 through 46, how he's going to fit into our terrific trio. Even after Jesus had performed so many signs in their presence, they still would not believe him. This was to fulfill the word of Isaiah the prophet, "Lord, who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed?" For this reason, they could not believe, because Isaiah says elsewhere, "He has blinded their eyes and hardened their hearts, so they can neither see with their eyes nor understand with their hearts, nor turn, and I would heal them." Isaiah said this because he saw Jesus' glory and spoke about him. Yet at the same time, many, even among the leaders, believed him. But because of the Pharisees, they would not openly acknowledge their faith for fear they would be put out of the synagogue, for they loved human praise more than praise from God. Then Jesus cried out, "Whoever believes in me does not believe in me only, but in the one who sent me. The one who looks at me is seeing the one who sent me. I have come into the world as a light, so that no one who believes in me should stay in darkness." He was literally sent by God. He was in fullness, sent in greatness. He was born into greatness, born with a mission. He lived and fulfilled it. He died for it, rose again. And now we have a chance to carry on his greatness. We have to live like him, not how the world around us lives. He didn't come to conquer or overpower. Jesus served, he taught, he was patient, kind, and understanding. Those words aren't always applicable to me. We read in Matthew 20, verse 20 through 28. Oh, that's the story. I don't have the whole verse. I just have one verse. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. That's how we can be great. The story goes that two brothers had their mother ask Jesus how they could get promoted to the big boy table in heaven and sit next to him on both sides. And I don't know much about culture back then, but I know now if you want a promotion, you don't send your mommy to talk to the boss. So that's probably step one of what not to do. Whoever wants to be great among you must be your servant. It's not the ideal path to greatness to our culture. Sure, they say work hard, you know, put all your hours in and go above and beyond. But they don't exactly tell you to, humble yourself before each other. They tell you to, you know, brag about yourself, get yourself on the top of the top rung of the totem pole or the top of the ladder. But that's exactly why Jesus said it, I think. If you read through any of the four Gospels, he spent his almost entire lifetime being countercultural. And in our culture, being the boss isn't so great. To serve one another is to show compassion and love. So I ask you today, Grace Christian Fellowship, how can you serve your neighbor? The worship team can come on up. How can you humble yourself? How can you find yourself to be truly great? In any situation, whether it's that you were born into a certain family dynamic, you're underappreciated at work, or your life seems to be taking a turn for the worse, these situations can be turned around for his good. So from now on, try to recognize the opportunities for greatness. I'm going to go ahead and pray. God, we want to thank you for our day today. Thank you for the opportunity for greatness this afternoon, God. I just pray as we leave this building, we can spend time with you, and we know what you command us to do, what your will is for us, God. And I just pray that we take opportunities to be humble, to live for you. We know that you have the power and the authority. And so we're going to take this time to worship how great you are, God.